Welcome to Kentish, the Formula Ford podcast. You've reached episode 3, which means the honeymoon is over. The engine is broken in and things are getting well sorted out. With that said, today's guest is one of my favorite people to talk to, as he brings in not only a great perspective on issues, but it also throws in humor, while all the while showcasing his love for the history of the sport and those involved. Sam Smith is his name, and he's best known for his work at Road & Track magazine, which I highly recommend you research. He can also be found on NBC Sports Network's Proving Grounds television program. Sam dabbled in Formula Ford in 2014, and is still in love with the class. So while his time behind the wheel of Formula Ford may be the shortest in nature of all of our guests, I thought his view on things as a whole would be fun for all to listen to. So without further hesitation, here's Sam Smith. Sam, welcome to Kentish.
Hey, thanks for having me. I'm a huge fan of everything you do and also Formula Ford, so it works out.
Oh, that's precious. Thank you. So you've driven most things that have been invented to take to the asphalt, some mundane, some silly, some absurd, and some of the most brilliantly engineered racing machines that we've all drooled over or lusted over. To say that you have experience driving cars would be akin to saying that Paul Newman had blue eyes. No, sir, Paul Newman had the blue eyes.
Well, thanks. I have a weird day job that almost doesn't even qualify as a job, and I can't complain. You're right. It's been an interesting and strange career.
Yeah.
What are we? Episode 3? Episode 4? I'm stoked you're doing this, man. This is
3. This is 3 for Dale. I mean, we're all in. So at this point, there's no going back. And I know with that being said, this for sure is not your first podcast, yet I thought we'd explore just kind of a small slice of your life with FF that may be kind of overlooked in your history by some, and probably in no small way made you appreciate open wheel cars kind of all the more.
Oh, God, yeah. I mean, talk about something I've loved since I was little, man. I mean, half the reason I wanted a Ford was because, you know, the same reason everybody else wants a Ford. You know, there's some small piece of the rock that you get when you strap into a car like that, because it's every bit of the dream of all the stuff that normal people don't have access to, right? It feels like it's bigger than it is. You know?
Mm-hmm. When you said part of the rock, all I could think of was the Aggro Craig from Nickelodeon's, I forget what show that was, but... Anyways, as I kind of mentioned in my forerunner to this, this one might go a little off track, and I'm 100% okay with it. All right, so being our third guest, my previous two guests are in their 30s and early 40s. Obviously, you're in that same bit. We're kind of the exception, not the rule, in Formula Ford in all cases, not even, you know, not just vintage, not just modern, as a whole. I'm not sure where this all goes after our generation, but we'll kind of touch with that at the end of our chat. So let's get into the mind of Sam. It no doubt has a gooey layer of gelatin, duct tape, and BMW interior dust, but let's just dive in.
Nobody wants to go into the mind of Sam.
Yeah. Welcome. Yeah, it's
not,
like,
not a happy place. It's mostly just like sugar-coated icing and melted down dreams, but
I like it.
What's up?
Let's get into the start of when you started racing. And why? I know your dad was a master mechanic of all things British, and then turned his mind to everything Italian.
I don't. I think he would be deeply offended by you calling him a master mechanic. He was like me, in that given enough time and enough tools and enough of stubborn mindedness, you know, anything is possible, up to and including fixing and making stuff. But you know, compared to somebody like your Paul J or you and your dad, I mean, we're not.
Trust me. It's all an illusion. We're in the same ballpark. We just gloss over it and swear louder. That's all.
I grew up right around the time, I guess I was in middle school or late elementary school. My dad opened a restoration shop that focused on pre-war MGs and the traditional, you know, pretty much anything and everything British that came into this country after the war. And race cars kind of filtered through that as a matter of course. Mm-hmm. And he had a bunch of friends in the SCCA, and we got into random autocrossing. And it was just one of those things where I slowly started hanging out at racetracks and meeting people who knew things. And it just kind of went from there. We built an improved touring car out of an old BMW 2002 when I was roughly in college. And I ended up selling furniture and holding down 3 jobs to pay for tires and used brake pads and things like that. But I mean, I don't know, man. I kind of got into it. My dad never forced it on me. I just kind of got into it in the same way that anybody gets into it. You know, you walk out in the garage and look at something and go, what's that? And 6 hours later, you haven't left.
So the most intriguing part of everything you just said to me was that you sold furniture. And I'm thinking to myself, was it luxury furniture? Was it Amish? Like, I want to know that part because, of course, it's me.
No. I mean, let's see. So it's about halfway through the season and you have three sets of completely spanked tires. And you look around your living room and you're like, well, I have a couch and then there's a love seat and a coffee table.
Oh, you sold furniture that way.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I basically ended up tearing down the remains of my college apartment by getting rid of most of it and trading it for tires. And then when those tires were inevitably used up and terrible and gone and there was nothing left in my house, I should have been happy about it, but probably wasn't because, you know, the race car didn't have any tires anymore.
But you say that, you know what you didn't have to do when you were done with college? Move all that furniture.
Yeah, right. Bright side. Look on the bright side.
Yeah. But, so where was the seed set in your mind that you liked cars and you wanted to race them?
Oh, Jesus. That's like saying, when did you know that you'd like to eat food in order to stay alive? I mean, I can remember. I mean, everybody has some of the same touch points, but just all filtered through different scenes, right? You know, for me, it was... I was 8 or 9 years old, and Dad brought home a VHS tape of the Terrell McQueen movie, Le Mans, and I watched it 300 times. And, you know, I ended up filtering through books and staring at pictures of guys like Nuvolari or Fangio in Mercedes-Benzes and Alphas and just losing my mind over how cool it must have been. I remember the first time going to a racetrack. You know, you do that thing where your first time at a track, you stand next to a corner and something goes by, and it breaks your brain, and the noise, and the sight, and the sound, and it's, I mean, it sounds cliche to say it, but you sit there, and you know that you're never going to be the same again, and you know that some way, somehow, you have to be a part of it, and, you know, the three sold couches and one hocked rug on the street later, and, you know, you're like a junkie looking for heroin, but...
I'm in favor, yes.
It's a downward spiral from there.
Awesome. So out of the 43 individuals I have in mind for season one of Kentish, and yes, that's 43 because, you know, King Richard, you probably have the shortest tenure of time in Formula Ford out of all of them. But I know you, out of anyone, can kind of pack a punch describing Formula Ford and what it means to the world of racing. So to start off, the seedlings, what drew you towards Formula Ford?
Well, it was... I mean, I want to say it was the racing, but more it was the cars, right? Mm-hmm. Because everybody on some level, you get a racing license and you start thinking about where you're going to go with it. And you have, when you're building a car or, you know, your license comes in the mail or you go to racing school or whatever the hell it is that gets you kicked off on it, you have this vision of yourself clipping over an apex or putting a pass together or even just climbing into the car and belting in, and whatever it is, whatever that weird little utopia in your brain is that you're shooting for, mine was always bifurcated. There was one that was, you know, I grew up loving touring cars and anything with doors and anything with a roof. I love tin tops because they're just the stuff that you drive every day. It's normal cars. It's a car. And that was split down the middle. And on one half, it was that. And on the other half, it was everything that Colin Chapman ever did, and Jack Brabham's grinning face, and, you know, what Grand Prix cars from between the wars look like, and the evolution that happened between 1960 and 1975 at Indy, and all of it, and all of that stuff was somehow filtered into this, you know, the other postage stamp half of my brain to where, you know, I knew that I somehow wanted to dip my toe in both of them, and what that meant, you know, what that ultimately ended up in was me buying a car I probably shouldn't have bought and doing the world's shortest season and shortest Formula Ford career in it. But I bought the thing. I did what you're never supposed to do. And I knew the difference is I think I knew that it was dumb and I did it anyway because it was dumb, which is probably the best way to describe most of my life.
That's a sign that we all have the same fever. So,
But I bought a car based on what it looked like and felt like and meant to me emotionally and not what it meant as a racing product, right? You know, if every racing driver looks at, and I'm, again, there was a large voice in my head saying, you don't want this. This isn't competitive. It's not the fastest. It's old. It's floppy. You're probably going to die in it. You know, the race driver voice that says, go buy the best tool for the job and who cares what it is or what it looks like, was drowned out by the guy who saw a cigar-bodied thing in skinny tires and, you know, looked at the dash and looked at the wheel. And, you know, I ended up with an Lexus, a Mark 14, with some Mark 15 parts on it, which was basically a long, squinty-eyed copy of the Lotus 51 that founded the series. Sure. And it just, you know, to me, I looked at that and I somehow saw everything from Jimmy Clark to Ayrton Senna to, you know, every childhood dream I had, because I'm a giant dork. Yeah. It ended up, you mentioned a short career. I think I did 3 races and maybe 1 test day in it. Mm-hmm. And then we ended up moving cross country and I had to sell a car. But a lot of stuff I'd do differently. And that's probably one of them, but also one of those things I wouldn't change at all. You know,
yeah.
It's weird.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And the funny thing is, you bought a car that was actually put together and running. that's more than probably 80% of the shit that I've drugged back to the shop. So you were ahead of the game. You're not fooling anyone there.
Well, that's part of it too, right? Because at some point, you know that there are, you know, every race car that's sold is ready to race is not. Mm-hmm. And you know that on some level, you're going to have to deal with whatever the hell it is that you drag home, whether it's a running, driving thing or a tub of bits. And you know that you're going to have to sort it. And I figured, well, I might as well start with as far down that path as I can, because every other race car or street car I'd ever owned had been the opposite end of the spectrum, where it's like, how little sense can I make with this? And is it a dumb idea? And I think so, yes, let's go.
Yeah.
So I ended up with something shiny that's, you know, had a kind of a bag of bits motor in it, but was otherwise half decent. And again, a thousand things I would have done differently and a thousand things I wouldn't have.
So of those 3 races and 1 test day, which is 1 more test day than I've ever done. I just show up and race, which is weird and probably has set me back some. What do you miss most about racing your Formula Ford?
Oh, man. There was something. So we talked about this a little offline earlier. You know, one of the great things about vintage Formula Ford racing in the United States is the tires. The fact that they run. Most of the sanctioning bodies believe that those cars should be run on a treaded, hard tire that likes a lot of slip angle, that doesn't slow the car down with a smidge of yaw, and that will carry a traditional, like classical, fingers on the wheel, dainty four-wheel drift, and not drifting in the sense of drifting, like modern people know it, but drifting in the sense of like what Taruffi and what Nuvolari wrote about in the books, you know, the sense that the car is kind of up on plane and arcing through the corner with neutral steer on it and not an ounce of yaw, and it's sliding, but it's not slowing down, right?
Right, it's, you know, just delightful, yeah.
Right, the typically classical thing that doesn't really, like modern race cars don't, modern race tires don't want the same kind of behavior, and that fit the behavior of that chassis. You know, it was a 60s space frame chassis. There was relatively nothing to it, and had really simple A-arms on it and kind of spindly little uprights in the back. And it was it didn't want to be driven the way that anything modern wants to be driven. And I'm sure even a Ford 5 or 6 years newer would want to be driven.
Mm-hmm.
And I just, having to rewire my brain every time I got into it, crossed with all the traditional gorgeous stuff you get in any race car, right? And any single-seater, period, that deep, intense sense of focus, because you're in a tool that has one purpose, and that one purpose could not be more obvious if you tried. And it's not a converted road car. It's not, you know, somebody's spun up in their backyard piece of art that just happens to not have a license plate on it. It is built for a purpose. And the class is, you know, that's what's always drawn me to that class, is that it is so focused on ordinary people having some shot at, you know, like I said, a piece of the rock, right?
Right, right. So on the other end of the spectrum, what do you not miss about your Formula Ford?
What do I not miss? Man, I do not miss nut and bolting the entire thing between every session. I do not miss that thing where there's like 2 minutes left to go before the grid closes and you're changing gears and you can't get the back of a Hewland on and you're fighting it and yelling at it. And it's doing that thing where it's like, click, 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 nothing, bang, and if there's that last, what is it, like half inch, three quarters of an inch, where it just won't go,
and then
you pull the whole thing off, and you look at it, and you piss at it, and you give it all the fingers you've got, and then you try again and again and again and again, and then at the absolute last minute, you're covered in gear oil, and it just goes clunk.
Yes.
Like, I miss the clunk. I don't miss everything leading up to it.
And there's that wonderful feeling of perfection when it finally does go clunk.
Yeah.
And I can't, I don't think there's anything else in life where it's like, oh, that automatic feeling like, oh, thank God, I don't have to take all that off, realign the pinion, everything, you know, I am so happy, you know, to your point, I get it. I get it so much. And especially right now, I miss that right now, which is saying a great deal.
You know, the other thing I don't miss is, you know, because it's a vintage class, and vintage is not, it's inherently not policed. You know, there were guys that, you know, show up with, you know, 100 extra CC they shouldn't have had, or...
Oh, I know.
You
know, yeah.
I mean, I don't miss driving the pants off the thing and then doing everything I knew to get out of the car, which, again, was, you know, I don't get paid to drive cars for a reason.
Mm-hmm.
Doing everything I could to get a lap out of the car and then, you know, getting within a couple of inches of somebody's gearbox on exit, and then having that person just slowly, you could see the moment where they then, as opposed to just hucking the car through the corner, they drove the thing through the corner and then put their foot down.
Mm-hmm.
That moment where you just want to take the steering wheel and throw it into the weeds because everything you just did was for naught.
Yep.
Like, don't miss that at all. But the rest of it was great. The rest of it was just great.
Sadly, I felt that in every single car I've ever been in, so I'm not quite sure what it is. Maybe I should check to make sure I got full pedal. In a dream scenario, let's say you die and you go to whatever heaven that Sam Smith believes in, and God says, Samuel, you can have any race car on any track with an abundance of tires. What would it be?
I don't know, but I love how he sounds like drunk Laurence Olivier.
It was either going to be that or Cletus the slack-jawed yokel. I could go either way. Or she, for that matter, because we don't know anything.
If there is a creator, an all-knowing being, I like to think that he sounds like a mid-century British stage actor who is half in the sauce. Any race car at all? The soup to nuts? Anything?
Let's do any Formula Ford, any track. Go.
Any Formula Ford and any track. Man.
Yeah.
Well, given that I've only driven one of them.
Yep. But let's say there's one or two that you've aspired to, because we obviously know that the form pulls you in more than function, since it all has the same function.
Yeah.
So where are you at?
Okay, so this is interesting, right? Because it comes back to the bifurcated weirdness that is my head, right? So there's you say that, and the first thing that goes through my head is a split screen, and on the left hand side is a Gurney Eagle. You know, the is an eaglet, because mm-hmm. I'm such a sucker for Dan and Rem and that whole shop and everything that came out of there. And that's, again, it's a tiny piece of that rock. Plus, it's a pretty elegant race car that just has a number of neat little solutions to problems that, you know, are inherent to Formula Fords.
Mm-hmm.
And that's one of them. And then on the other hand, the other answer is, because there is a large part of my brain that is just that pure racer jackass who has, you know, one answer to one problem is, well, what's everybody else running, and what's the fastest tub? You know, what's the hot chassis? Who's running what? Who's building motors, and what's the thing that's at the front? I want that.
Yeah.
You know, it's, and then there's the, again, I those words leave my mouth, and the voice in the back of my head goes, yeah, but is it pretty?
Yeah. No, I get it. And that's the thing about, like, today's cars. I don't think there's been a pretty Formula Ford that's come out since 1993. But also that's me in that way of, I don't like anything new, without also putting me in that typecast of being 80 years old. And, you know, back in my day, I don't know how to finish that sentence because I'm 80, apparently. No offense to the 80-year-olds listening.
No, but there's nothing wrong with being old, but there is that whole thing where, like, I mean, and I'm stuck in the same problem, right?
Because yeah.
I like classically designed, simple things, mm-hmm. and most new stuff just is not. You know, complexity does not lead itself to simplicity, mm-hmm. as dumb as that sounds. But, I mean, so what does that work out to for you? Is that a Swift of some flavor, or what? What?
I believe, and I actually posted a photo yesterday of the car that I think was the last just eye killer, was the Swift DB6, which, as I learned, was a, you know, a FF2000 car that was basically converted. But, you know, I love its, like, little pouty nose on it that looks like somebody kicked it and it just stuck there. I love that about it. And of course, the classic side NACAs of the DB1 series that kind of carried over to the DB6. I love that look.
Just giant NACA ducks on it. It's almost cartoonish.
We're going to make the whole thing a NACA duck. Well, let's do it. I mean, why not? It works. In all your days racing, and obviously it was more on the club level, you did some MX-5 Cup stuff, which we will not talk about. If there was a driver out there that you ran with that you thought, man, this guy or gal is so talented, I hope they make it to the top, who would that be?
Oh, man. I honestly don't have an answer because mm-hmm. there's always, most of what we did was regional stuff, FCCA regional stuff before I got into vintage. And, after that, maybe the occasional national here. There's always somebody at the front, and I guess it's more of an archetype, right? It's mm-hmm. a person. There's always somebody at the front who has every last ounce of their stuff together, right? The car is immaculate. Mm-hmm. They rip off perfect laps. They are somehow pulling out tents that you didn't think were there, and more important, the guy behind him or the guy two cars back behind those two didn't think were there. Mm-hmm. And it's like there's one in every region. There's one in every class. The guy who, or gal, whoever it is, who took prep and talent and mixed it all together and somehow ended up with just something. And on that weekend, and you always come away from this and you look at it and you're like, I mean, the last Spec Miata race I ran was at Groton, Michigan. Mm-hmm. Groton Raceway in Belding, Michigan, mm-hmm. on the west side of the state. And I remember that weekend, I was like third or fourth or ninth or whatever the hell it was. But that weekend, there was one dude who would rip over, I remember watching him practice because there was a point where I had to miss a practice and stand by the side of the track. And I remember watching the guy practice and he'd rip over the jump and the first two, three corners of the track in a way that I didn't quite understand where he was putting the speed in the car, but it made sense.
Yeah.
That archetype of that person. And that's what's so great about club racing is that there's always somebody that you look at and you think, man, I bet they'd be really good if somebody would just give them a top flight car and fund them. Right. And 99.9% of the time that never happens. And, you look at pro racing. Mm-hmm. You and I both know people that deserve far better than they get.
Right.
And we have mutual friends who deserve far better than they get. Right. And that's a type. And that's part of what makes club racing so great and so heartbreaking at the same time,
Right. Absolutely. So you still race on occasion, and I know there's been a few occasions where it's been the father-son BMW. What is it you're getting strapped into nowadays?
I don't actually run anything actively anymore. Mm-hmm. I haven't in probably about a year or so, but
yeah.
There was a period of about 4 or 5 years where I was sharing a B sedan BMW 2002 in a series on the West Coast. That's just a kind of a regional club series for vintage guys. It was all relatively competitive, not hugely competitive, mm-hmm. but I loved that. We were running, there was a period up until, I guess, 3 or 4 years ago, I was pretty regularly doing AR races in a number of different things. Everything from E30s and E36s to a friend had an NC MX-5 Cup car we ran.
Mm-hmm.
They were just like split 9 hours, 2 9-hour races over the course of a weekend. And, we had some luck there and did pretty well. I loved that stuff. I love enduros. The last thing I strapped into was actually my first race in probably about a year,
mm-hmm.
maybe 9 months, was at the 25 Hours of Underhill. Some friends of mine and I ran a Speccy 46 and did relatively okay till one of our team members put the car off and tore a radiator out of it. Put a radiator in, and then another guy put the car off again and tore that radiator out of it, put a second radiator in, and then about 3 hours later, another guy put the car off and threw the radiator out of it.
Okay.
And we found a third radiator and somehow finished the race, but...
Wow.
I'm getting off at a tangent, but I wish I could say I actively campaigned something, but it more just tends to be random things here and there.
Yeah, yeah. And I figured as much, but to find that out, I thought it'd be interesting. Okay. The next thing I'm going to bring up... And I can't believe I'm doing this. I'm going to do this for you, and it'll probably never happen again. This will be an ink blot in words, because, again, I just want to see, when I say something, what you have to say for it.
Okay.
So it's going to be a word or a small phrase, and you just tell me what comes to mind.
All right. Is this one word or small phrase, or is it, like, Multiple?
It'll be multiple. It'll be about 8 or 9 things.
Okay. Cool. Shoot.
All right. The aptly named Smith's Gauges.
Jesus. Breaking.
Okay. Goodwood.
Ah, one of the better weekends of my life.
Yep. Denise.
Writing and one of the reasons why I'm here.
Dan Gurney.
A dinner at the Henry Ford Museum I had with him about 9 months before he died. I take that back, it wasn't a dinner, it was a lunch. Mm-hmm. This is more than one word, but you're going to get it, whether you want it or not.
No, you can explain all you want. I'm going to give you one word, and you can go on for 15 minutes for all I care. This is your show. I'm just on it.
I wish I'd known that. Don't say that.
Shall we start over? We can start over. I can start over with the segment. I have the ability to edit.
Never say you can go on and on to a writer with a Jewish mother. You'll be there for 6 months. So Dan Gurney, the thing that comes to mind off of that, about 6 months, 9 months, a year before he died, he was given an award at the Henry Ford Museum, and there was a commemorative lunch for it in Dearborn, in Michigan. And somehow, I was living in Ann Arbor, a little college town outside of Detroit at the time, and somehow I got invited to go to it, and who says no? So me and my boss went down, and we sat down at the table with Dan and about 6 or 7 other journalists, and there was a couple other tables in the room. We were lucky enough to be sitting with him. And he was about 2 people away, and everybody just kept asking him questions about what he thought about things he had done. Mm-hmm. And I remember just wanting to know what the guy thought about the world as it sat. And by the time there was finally a break in the conversation, I don't even remember what I asked or whether it was my boss or whatever happened, but there was a break in the conversation at one point, and somebody, it may have been me, it may have been somebody else, I don't remember, but all I remember is his answer. And his answer was something like, because the question was something along the lines of beauty and art and grace in design. Mm-hmm. And he paused for a second, and he chuckled, and he gave that laugh. The laugh was that laugh that you know, and mm-hmm. the smile was the smile that you know, because Dan was Dan. And he paused for a second, and he said, well, you know, I always kind of believed that if you have the chance to make something beautiful, and you don't, what does that say about you?
Mm-hmm.
And that stuck with me, and it stuck in my head, and it every time I'm fixing something, making something, painting my house, maybe I'm just a giant romantic dorkwad, but that... I don't know. That stuck with me, and it mm-hmm. rings a bell. It rang a bell on some primordial level, and it's, you know, you look back on it, it's the reason, you know, it's the reason half the eagles had beaky noses and looked like birds in flight. Mm-hmm. It's the reason the long tail on the eaglet is there. It's the reason that, like, the guy just believed in, for all he was an engineer and Mr. Science when it came to making things faster, he just believed in beauty and in art and in grace. And you and I both know that that is not common in motorsport, because motorsport is a cold, hard-edged world where most of the people who do well lean into the numbers and nothing else. And the fact that one of history's great Americans and one of the great geniuses of our sport was a dude who probably on some level had the soul of a poet, mm-hmm. just meant something to me, because ultimately, you know, I'm a big softy inside. I know every writer is, you know, we all believe on some level that art and beauty and truth are more important than the ones and zeros.
Yeah.
And it's probably why none of us make any real money, but it pushed a button for me. And that's what toes in when I think of Dan Gurney and how lucky I was to be in the room when he smiled, because he gave the smile and there was a pause that, you know, that the guy was no stranger to that truth, right?
Yeah.
It meant a lot to me.
Yeah, you hit something on a nuclear level.
Yeah.
Okay. Camaraderie in sport.
Oh, God. Bullshit.
Bullshit? No, last week we found out it was everything.
No, it is. But, like, it's that whole notion where camaraderie is everything in sport, except right up until the flag drops.
Okay.
Right up until somebody is like, hey, man, I need this.
Yep.
are you a nice person? And yeah. He's like, well, I'm a nice person and I will help you right up until the point that it takes something away from me.
Yes, right up until the point where the A-arm crashes into my helmet, yes.
Yeah, exactly. No, that paints me more cynical than I really am. But
yeah. No, I hear you.
You know, it's genuine, it's real. It's just, I love the, one of the great things about racing is how that thing exists right up until it doesn't. And right up when it doesn't, everybody's generally like, yep, that should not exist right now because I need to be where you are, get behind me, you know?
Okay, the term period correct.
Oh, fappery. I am deeply, deeply a man who believes that if you're restoring something or chasing something or putting a piece of history back together, it needs to be as it was. But I also believe that, you know, there comes a time when you can obsess too much over the details and lose sight of the bigger picture. And I don't mean that to knock making something right and correct. I more mean that I believe in the spirit of the law and not the letter of it, right?
Yeah.
Which means that in, you know, history was a messy place, and believing that there is ever anything that was nail downable for any one minute, it's probably to misunderstand that moment in time. That's part of what makes the study and appreciation of history so great, right? Is that there were, you know, people fetishize the 1960s, 70s, or the 30s, or the 90s, but and trying to distill that stuff down into a sentence or an idea. But ultimately, like, you know, the world has always been a messy place, and I love pulling out a moment in time and imagining the way a machine was, or a writer was thinking, or a film director was thinking at that point. But when people go too off in the weeds and turn it into something like cosplay or obsession over, you know, who used what type of pencil when he drew this, I'd maybe step back. But the principle and the song of the thing, but not the actual notes, if that makes sense.
It does. It absolutely does. The last one. And this, it's not a Formula Ford one, but one simple car I'll ask you about. The Lotus 7.
Oh, man. Colin Chapman, right? I mean, I love, I actually was just right before you called, there's a two-volume set that was written, I think, at some point in the 70s or 80s. Doug Nye wrote the first one, and a guy named Ian Smith wrote the second one. But it's a history of Lotus, right?
Mm-hmm.
And a history of Lotus is a history of Chapman's obsessions, because Chapman was a man of the moment. And for all of the guy's genius, you know, everybody knows that his big problem was that he would get bored with a project halfway through and not finish it. And all the drivers who drove for him loved him as much as they hated him. You know, you ask Mario or even Dan or anybody about him, and it was always a smile and a laugh and then an eye roll, because Colin was apparently that guy that everybody knew, where it's like, yeah, it's Colin. And he was so good and so much a disaster at the same time.
Yeah.
And such a used car salesman in so many ways. But the 7 is fascinating because it was a thing that existed in a moment for him. And the moment he was done with it, he moved on, right?
Mm-hmm.
And yet the fact that it's still built in some way, like, you know, you can go to Caterham Cars in England and order up 150 horsepower Caterham that looks and smells and feels almost exactly like a Lotus 7 has felt for, or the 7 has felt for the better part of its half-century history.
Mm-hmm.
And there are more frame tubes, and the suspension has been optimized a little more, and it works a little better than it did, but it is ultimately a 1960s car dragged into the modern era. And what's so great about it is that it was his ideal, Chapman's ideal, for a split second of what a sports car should be, and yet he would probably be disgusted, because he was Chapman, with the fact that somebody was still making it and fetishizing it 50 years later. And that's the great dichotomy of the guy. On the one hand, he had this innate ability to see engineering problems as holes and not parts. And on the other hand, he was just completely dead for the forest for the trees. He could not see on some level. He kept trying to take Lotus up market and turn it into a company that made cars in no way like what made the mark and what made the mark legend. And, you know, I love the 7 in part because it represents everything the guy was about, but also his greatest failing and the fact that he was human. Because this gets back to the storytelling, right? Because ultimately what makes somebody interesting is not what they do well, it's their flaws. You know, just as you know, any story is only really interesting when you get to the part that went wrong, you know, the third act complication. The Seven is a reminder of just how human the guy was, and, you know, just what he wanted out of engineering, Formula One, cars, and, you know, the number of falling outs he had with people, all of it. I mean, it is to me so much, you know, set aside the fact that you get into one and you drive one and it's a hoot and a half, and, you know, there is nothing like a car that is essentially just, I mean, the early Sevens were basically just stretched out. You know, there were Formula Fords before Formula Fords existed, right?
Mm-hmm.
With a stick axle on the back. Mm-hmm. But set aside the fact that they are just gobs of giggles to drive fast or slow, you know, ultimately they remind me of a human. And, you know, I can't say that any car that has ever made me think about what makes a person tick, in as much as it makes me giggle, was a bad time. <That's>, if we're ultimately in this for a good time,
yeah,
you know, that's probably as high a praise as you can get in my book.
Yeah. So during this uncertain time that we're living in, something's happened.
Whatever do you mean?
I don't even know right now. Why? Of course, the oil embargo.
Of course. Why not? That's normal.
Yeah, Donahue's going to win Indy this year. So back in September, you wrote an article for Road and Track that hit the world entitled "Losing Your Mind in Online Racing." 6 months later, we're all losing our freaking minds, and some of us are online racing. It is terribly addictive, isn't it?
It is, right? And I know you, we've talked about this before. Like, you and I both found Grand Prix legends in high school, college at some point.
Yep, high school.
And it's like, there is something about it that, because it is, it's driving, and yet it's not at all driving.
Right.
It is that same science and chasing tenths and thinking about it. And, you know, I have a small little sim rig at home that has relatively decent, relatively powerful force feedback base and a load cell on the brake pedal, and the whole thing is geared toward being as consistent and stable as possible, so that I can go hack around and do my journalist worst at driving a race car. And, like, it's the same mindset, and you build up a sweat, and you get tense, and you start thinking about it, and when you put the car on the wall because, you know, well, you're in a GT3 Cup car, and you're going for that last tenth at the Glen, you know, if you don't park it at the bus stop, I mean, what do you do? Why are you
yeah,
there?
Yeah, why are you even living? Yeah.
Right. And, you know, that, like, all of it's set up to do that, and it puts me in the same mental space, and it scratches the itch a little.
Yeah.
It is not the same thing, but at the same time, there is nothing else that even comes close.
Right.
So it's like, well, I mean, if you like a glass of beer or a drink of whiskey and you can't have that anymore, I mean, a cup of coffee isn't the same thing, but it does something.
It'll
get
you there. and to that end, so I've never actually had anything force feedback. My whole life, I ran with a keyboard. And for 2 years, I ran with a Microsoft wheel and pedals from, like, the 90s, doing the Apex Speed Winter Series in a Spec Racer Ford.
Wait a minute. So you're telling me you sat there and clicked off laps by going left, right, left, right, left, right, left, 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 right, 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 right.
Mr. Smith, I threw away the steering wheel 2 years ago, and that's how I still do it. So people joke with me when I post a photo at the track, you know, did you get a new keyboard this time? You know, because that's just what I learned. So, but what's weird is I have an Asus laptop that I use for, you know, working at home, and I actually wore out the key I was using for braking. So it throws off my whole, that whole muscle memory of, oh, hit the brakes. No, that's not a pedal anymore, because that's not a key anymore. And also, you're on a laptop, you fool. So
you are a deliciously broken man, Mr. Sang. That is the strangest thing I've heard in a while.
Well, wait, buckle up. Wait until you know me better. All right. So to hit on your 9-to-5 job, just a pinch, tell me about the media in 2008 versus 2020. How has being a journalist changed?
Man, so I am, for anybody who doesn't know, I am an editor at large at Road and Track magazine, which basically means I am in the same job that, I am deeply uncomfortable even saying this, because the guy is one of the reasons I'm a writer, but I'm in the same job that Peter Egan was in for a long time, which basically means I'm what they call a story horse. I'm kind of a jack of all trades. I go, I do things, I report on stuff, I chase things that are happening in the industry, I help edit and help assemble the magazine, and work with the guys running the website to help assemble that. I basically just chase a little bit of everything we do and help put together events and all that stuff. So I've been here since 2012. Mm-hmm. Before that, I was a car driver for a little bit. I was freelance. I worked for Jalopnik for a little bit. I got my start freelancing for the BMW Club at Roundel and ended up on staff at Automobile Magazine. And that is about a decade and a half of job. And you're not kidding, man. In the past decade, especially since 2008, 2009, the media business is, it's not even apples to oranges. It went from being an apple to an elephant. You know, it is still a living thing that at some point, you know, takes in one thing and extrudes something else through a product. But it is never the thing that makes it interesting for me is that it changes every day. And at the core, you are still focused on storytelling and figuring out what's compelling about something. Whatever that is, whether it's something somebody does or something somebody did, something happening in the world, a machine, a moment in history, a moment in time that's happening now, you're focused on chasing that. Mm-hmm. Difference is how that is the medium, right? The old the Marshall McLuhan hackneyed line is that the medium is the message. Well, in media, the medium is everything, because if you don't have a way to talk to people, you don't have a way to get a story, no matter what that story is, to people. And in the past 10 years, we have gone from a relatively long attention span on the part of most people and a thriving print business to a relatively weak print business. And everybody has about 6 seconds of attention, mm-hmm. because that's about how long it takes you to realize you need to scroll up on your phone and then do it and scroll up on your phone. And then you're walking through the grocery as that happens. And also somebody's asking you another question and then a phone call comes in and then you need to go do something else and an email buzzes in and a thousand other things.
Yeah.
So the big change is that, you know, the ways and means of getting stories paid for and making the industry work are different, mm-hmm. much like motorsport, but at the core of it, you know, racing is still putting a human body in a car against another human body in a car.
For now.
For now, right. Journalism and storytelling are still figuring out what's important in the world and figuring out a way to communicate that. Yeah. And, you know, what I love about it is that I basically get paid to ask questions and be stupid guy in the room and say, raise my hand and go, how does this work?
And here I am asking you questions. So it's basically just a vicious circle that pulls us down into another region of the world. Wonderful.
Of course.
And it was funny, you hit on the medium. So I graduated from college in 2007. I was a PR major. And in my final semester, my professor, Mr. Smoody, if you're listening, hi, came into the room and said, hey, we're all going to record this new thing called podcasts. And I said, what the fuck is a podcast? You know, when you hear that word for the first time, you're like, is it something you throw in the dishwasher? What is this? And now here we are, March 26, 2020, doing this. So, well done, guy who taught me that, who was actually a lot of fun. PR didn't work out for me, but the family business did, so here we are.
Well, that's what's great, though, is that ultimately the big, you know, one of the other big changes in the past decade is that the democratization of voice, right? It is now possible for literally anybody to spool up and produce a neat thing and get that out to people, and that is magic, right? You know, the nature, the evolution of human history has been getting more voice and more power into the hands of more people, right? Mm-hmm. Whether it's through government or creation or storytelling or anything, right? And mm-hmm. that's what's neat about this point in history is that it's entirely possible to chase a thousand other things. And for somebody like you or me who has, you know, literally 10 million interests and not enough time for any of them.
No.
You know, you can go down any rabbit hole at any given point. You know there are 300 billion people down there with you, mm-hmm. being like, ooh, what's that?
Yeah, on that end, I know Conan O'Brien always rips on people who have very minute niche podcasts. He always makes fun of the guy with the buttons podcast. Welcome to Buttons. And it gets me every time because isn't Conan great? On that end, where do you see the future of racing as a whole going?
I don't know. You know,
it's a weird time to even think of that, but
yeah, totally. I mean, it's interesting, right? Because, you know, racing has this odd way of eating its own tail. The people in it are often not so much concerned with perpetuating the sport, mm-hmm. which ultimately means getting more, no matter who you are, it means getting more people to watch what you're doing yeah. and care about it, right?
Yeah.
You know, whether it's entirely separate from the business, if you have an audience, you have a thing. You know, there are auditoriums full of thousands of people watching teenagers play Fortnite, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, and that is a thing that no one could have imagined 15 years ago.
No.
But there is an audience, so it exists.
No, you would have been beaten up for saying that 15 years ago.
So much of motorsport is concerned with, you know, the guys who run teams, the guy from IndyCar and F1 on down. They are concerned with keeping the lights on and keeping people paying the bills mm-hmm. and not always the greater good of the thing, which is fine, right? You know, I am more concerned with paying my mortgage than I am with, mm-hmm. you know, any number of things, right? You know, everybody's concerned with their own deal, and there's nothing wrong with that.
Right.
But ultimately, motorsport has tended to be reactive and not proactive, whether it's, you know, the changes that the FIA makes or the changes that your local SCCA region make. It's all a result of something. From the car, somebody got killed in a car because this happened. Ah, we should change the cars to not be like that anymore.
Mm-hmm.
To, you know, these cars are too old to race now. We're screwed. We didn't see this coming. What do we do? Ah, well, let's invent a class for that thing over there.
Yeah.
You know, if there is a very much head in the sand, ostrichy quality to motorsport that I've never been a huge fan of,
mm-hmm.
in part because these are, you know, you know as well as anybody, the people in racing are deep, some of the most deeply imaginative, characterful human people anywhere, right?
Yeah.
And they have it in them to imagine some new form of whatever the hell we're doing and figure out what's going to be compelling.
Yeah.
But ultimately, you know, that always seems to get trod on by somebody saying this is the way we've always done it, or, you know, in the case of IndyCar or Formula One, well, I mean, if we do this, then all the people who liked this being done won't like it anymore. Well, they might go away or die or just walk away to begin with, you know?
Right.
And there is a reason that nobody shows up to sports car races anymore. There is a reason that half the IndyCar races on the calendar last year had giant empty stands. There's a reason that, you know, they can't make Formula One compelling and its audience numbers are dropping.
Mm-hmm.
Now, these are real problems. And if you do not address them at the root, which is this stuff simply isn't as interesting to the ordinary person as it once was,
mm-hmm.
you miss something. And nine times out of 10, they try and make it, you know, there's a caveat in media. You're supposed to build things for the reader you want, not the guy down the hall. You know, not meaning you build things for the person who's going to consume them, not the person who's working with you to make the thing.
Yeah.
It's part of why a lot of car magazines read like stereo instructions written for industry engineers. It's part of why a lot of journalism is written for people of a certain demographic on any subject,
yeah.
people of a certain demographic or people of a certain economic background or political background. You know, ultimately, you have to think about who you're trying to get in the room and what you want to say to them. And what amazes me is that racing, for all its genius, I mean, hell, man, the past 30 years of Formula One have been focused on chasing advancements that no one can see
mm-hmm.
that take away from what the driver is doing and minimize the human element. And also, when somebody wins, you don't know if it was him or the 300 aerodynamicists he has working on his behalf who made that winglet and that barge board and that dive plane just that much more effective. And, you know, I hope, to make a very long answer short, I hope the sport can pull its head out of its ass and start thinking about why it exists instead of just worrying about how it's going to continue to exist, you know?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Because there's still a lot left to love about,
Yeah, absolutely. And it's funny you brought up the ostrich in the sand. It reminded me, and this again shows you when you're in racing, you don't see anything but it. I was at a go-kart race in 2005, and there was a tornado watch out. And then there was a tornado warning out. And then came the tornado sirens. And then came the clouds that were going in all shapes and sizes of ways and twisting all about. And I looked over to the team next to me, And the mechanic, who's the dad, you could see he had a look on his face as if to say, do you think I'm going to have to pull two more teeth on the gear to get through that wind? And I kind of looked at him like, I just want to duck and cover. What is going on? But to that end, like, some people are so in where they don't see the tragedy that life is going on all around. And when you don't stop and just take in what's all beyond the steering wheel, life can bite you.
I mean, I wish I had a count on the number of pitches we get from PR representatives. Mm-hmm. And if any of you are listening, know who you are. PR reps, team owners, from drivers, you know, somebody somewhere wants you to pay attention to so-and-so because he got funded and he was 3/10 faster than so-and-so, or he won this championship. Well, you know what? I mean, that's not an interesting story. That's not an interesting, compelling arc. You know, the stuff that, you know, there are drivers at every level, from IndyCar and Formula One on down, who get a lot of media attention and simply aren't very good. Mm-hmm. And they have figured out how to be, and on the one hand, there's part of me that rails against that because that's not the point. On the other hand, there's a big part of me that's like, man, you are paying attention. Yeah. They've figured out how to be compelling and to make people pay attention. And as a result, sponsors care and they get internet traffic and podcast traffic and webcast traffic. And maybe you put them in an IndyCar or a stock car or whatever it is, and they are mid-pack. Yeah. And they can't make a bad team into a good one, and they can't chase setup. But they are compelling, interesting humans. Mm-hmm. And, you know, nobody likes a robot. Nobody likes the same story pitch over and over again. You know, so much of it comes down to thinking about what you're doing instead of just doing it. And we meet with young drivers constantly who don't seem to understand that it's not about how good you are in the car. How good you are in the car is the base, you know, that how well you can tell your story and how well you can make literally every other piece of the puzzle work. That's what matters. You know, if you're not Lance Stroll, you know, you're screwed, right? I mean, there is something bigger at the point, but anyway,
yes. Yeah.
That's a very long answer to a very short question.
That's okay. You brought up Lance Stroll, and I immediately stopped listening. So
like most of America.
Yes, and the world, perhaps, because that just is everything wrong. What do you recommend for someone who's looking at a Formula Ford as a first race car?
Ooh, interesting. You know, the time-honored advice, and again, this is coming from somebody who has a massive backlog, a three-race backlog in the class.
And that's why you're perfect. I'm trying to interview people who have all ranged. I have one guy who's been racing Formula Ford for over 40 years. And I was like, yeah, I'm going to find somebody with a small backlog who just dabbled and can give their viewpoint. So go.
Well, look, I mean, it's like anything else. Figure out what you want out of it and go from there. Mm-hmm. If you love the cars and you like hanging out and having a low-key weekend and you don't necessarily want to spend, you know, weeks and weeks and weeks chasing setup and thinking about whether or not you've got, if it's a Ford, that carb, or if it's the Honda, any number of other things dialed right, you know, go look at vintage and figure out how much it matters to you to go quickly or to have a pretty car, and then work toward that. If you simply want, you know, something that is fast and competitive and affordable, then, you know, do that equation for whatever the most modern chassis you can afford is, and aim at the runoffs. You know, there are the guys who have a bad time of it, mm-hmm, are always the guys who work in any class, in any series, anywhere, any form of club racing, are always the guys who work backward from something other than first principles and try and make a pig of a car happy, or try and learn in a car that falls apart every 5 minutes, you know, when they're just starting out so they never get the seat time they need,
yeah,
who believe that, you know, subtle cheat here and there is going to be worth more than another weekend of putting some miles in the car, sucking less. I mean, there's ultimately it just comes down to figuring out what you want out of it and then solving for that X. And that's it. I'm lucky enough that I had somebody tell me that a long time ago with regards to something else. And it happens that, you know, it works in any form of anything you dabble in life, whether that's, you know, racing or instruments or writing or reading or buying a house or whatever, right?
Mm-hmm.
But it amazes me how many people just kind of shoot from the hip and they're like, that didn't work out. And I spent, that? I spent tens of thousands of dollars doing this, and I was miserable, and I hated it. God, that's a terrible class. No, never doing it again.
Yeah.
But I had three silly-ass race weekends in an uncompetitive car with an uncompetitive motor in it, and I would do it all over again because I was just there because I love the car. You know, the racer voice in me was pissed that I didn't actually have the, you know, deeply competitive weekend of my dreams three times over, but that wasn't why I got into it. I knew that going on.
Yeah. Well, Sam, obviously you get to do things that make your inner child giddy. The fact that you showcase that inner child giddiness so outwardly makes me thrilled for you. You don't restrict yourself in that manner, which is a delight to behold for anyone who's met you or has heard you or read your writing. You get the thrill of it all. And the respect you have to drive a vintage car or a modern car, the respect you have for it all, and the respect you have for your own silliness, and the joy you bring other people, it just makes a stellar combo. And that's why I thought you'd be a terrific guest tonight, and obviously you have. So thank you for joining us here at Kentish.
Well, thank you for having me. It was a pleasure, man. Hope we can do it again.
Absolutely. Well, thank you for joining us.
All right.
That was a lot of fun. If you cannot tell Sam's love affair for automotive history and Formula Fords, you might have had the mute button on. If you like what you heard, you can find his work via Road and Track. I challenge you all to read his entire catalog of articles, ranging from racing a Jaguar XK120 at Goodwood to taking a two-day road trip with his daughter in a Citroen 2CV. His love for all things with wheels is a primal thing I found with all racers, and unlike many, his ability to put it all into words is a truly wonderful gift to behold. We'll be back with episode 4 of Kentish next week, where we'll have someone with a much longer history with Formula Fords than Sam, whom we'll announce midweek. As a side note, we picked up a minor sponsor in the past week, and it's actually my 9-to-5 employer, UEMSI HTV. UEMSI HTV is the world's largest distributor of thermoplastic sewer cleaning hose, and have been one of the leading manufacturers of inspection camera systems and sewer and vacuum truck replacement parts since 1989. For more about UEMSI HTV, visit UEMSI.com or give them a call today at 877-389-9999 and tell them Jacques sent you. If you like the way this is going, feel free to shoot me a message on Facebook or give us a rating. Furthermore, if there is someone you'd like to hear me have a conversation with, I'm all ears. For now, this is Jacques Driesing signing off for Kentish, the Formula Ford podcast.